Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups of the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update on Martin versus United States. Our panelist today is Patrick Giacomo. Patrick is a senior attorney with the Institute for Justice and one of the leaders of IJ's project on immunity and accountability. Before joining IJ, Patrick was a litigator at a private firm in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he cultivated a civil rights practice and handled a variety of cases in state and federal court. He earned his law degree from the University of Chicago and a degree in economics and political science from the University of Notre Dame. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker, their full bio can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speaker gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Caroline, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this, and thanks to everyone who's watching at home. So today I'm going to talk about a case that the Institute for Justice is going to argue before the Supreme Court on April 29th, called Martin versus United States. And like many Supreme Court cases, this case is both really simple on the one hand and really complicated on the other. And so the simple version here is that we represent an innocent family who was subjected to a wronghouse raid by an FBI SWAT team. And I'm going to get into the more complicated version of that, but I want to do a little bit of stage setting for the sort of broader principles at play, and then, of course, the more technical aspects of the fact that this case actually is one under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And so to set the stage a little bit, at the Institute for Justice, as Caroline mentioned, we have a project on immunity and accountability that's aimed at addressing the sorts of obstacles that are often run into by people who are trying to litigate civil rights or constitutional claims against the government. And so that might be claims under the Fourth Amendment. It could be tort claims, as in this case. It could be takings claims under the Fifth Amendment. And so one of the things that we realized was that when it comes to these wronghouse raids, it's a more common problem than certainly I had recognized. And B, as it turns out, when the police, whether they're state, local, or federal, do make a mistake and raid the wrong house. So something that could happen to any of us just by virtue of an external mistake made by a police officer, an FBI agent, there's very little that can be done to hold the officers accountable. And more importantly, frankly, to get a remedy for the innocent victims to say, hey, look, I was sitting in my house. You came in, you traumatized us, you destroyed a bunch of the house, and now you're going to leave me to pick up the pieces, both literally and figuratively. And so we can kind of start from the broader problem that the Fourth Amendment and its first principles was designed to address. And I think this is aptly contained in the famous expression from William Pitt, the English statesman, who said that the poorest man may in his cottage bid defiance to all forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England cannot enter. All his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement. And so this is the same thing that, you know, in the Fourth Amendment, our home is our castle. And this is the sort of first among equals of the property rights that are protected, and so on and so forth. But what we've realized at the Institute for Justice is that you have these rights, and they're very high-minded and they're extremely important. We have property rights that are central to the entire American design. But in reality, it's often extremely difficult to enforce these rights. And so in the span of the last year or so, without really meaning to, we accidentally collected these cases that we were interested in that involved wronghouse raids. They involved different legal issues. They took place in different parts of the country. And nevertheless, each one of them has been thrown out by courts. And so we had a case called Jimerson versus Lewis out of Texas, where local police raided the wrong address. I'm talking about the address on the warrant didn't match the address on the house. force. And in that case, the police officers got qualified immunity, even though they admitted that they violated the Fourth Amendment and that they didn't check the address on the house before they kicked in the door. In South Bend, Indiana, we represent a woman who was also raided because police thought a criminal was using her IP address and they were mistaken about that. And there we brought a Fifth Amendment takings claim to say, hey, when you came in and destroyed a bunch of my house, that was actually a taking for which I'm owed just compensation. And at least so far in that case, the lower courts have said no, that there's not a Fifth Amendment cause of action available for this type of government destruction. And then, of course, in this case, which we're now going to zoom in on, we have an FBI raid, which raises different questions and different problems. And fundamentally, this case is about the application of the Federal Tort Claims Act. And so let me get into the background of the law, and then we'll talk about what happened in this case, and we'll talk about the application and how it will have a broader reach. And so this case initially brought both Bivens causes of action and Federal Tort Claims Act claims. And to set the stage for that, as many of you surely know, Bivens is an implied cause of action that the Supreme Court recognized in a case called Bivens in 1971, saying basically, look, the Fourth Amendment doesn't say how it can be enforced, but we, the Supreme Court, are going to imply a cause of action that allows you to simply sue federal officers when they violate the Constitution for damages, in the same way that you're able to sue them under Section 1983 if they act under color of state law. And in recent years, the Supreme Court has really clamped down on this and restricted it to the point of leaving very little of Bivens itself. Bivens was a warrantless entry case where there was the use of excessive force by narcotics agents and a bunch of other little aspects. And in a case called Egbert versus Boulay a couple years ago, the Supreme Court really stripped down Bivens and basically said, hey, we think it's the prerogative of Congress to do the policy weighing in deciding whether someone should be allowed to bring a damages, i.e. money, cause of action against a federal officer for constitutional violations. And the theme of Egbert and the sort of cases that led up to it, starting in the early 2000s with Malesko, is that this is a separation of powers issue. It's not the prerogative of the judiciary, rather it's the prerogative of the legislature to provide a cause of action. And so we won't get into all the details of how it works and what's left, but that is the sort of animating concern that the Supreme Court has expressed in these cases. In this case, we have sort of the exact opposite scenario, because this is a case about the Federal Tort Claims Act. And as its name suggests, this is an act that was passed by Congress that waives sovereign immunity for certain torts committed by federal employees. And the statute's actually kind of a mess. I'm going to get into some of it now, but there's a ton more. We could talk for hours and hours about it, and it would be very boring to most people unless they're kind of immersed in this stuff. And so this statute was passed in 1946. It was the culmination of like three decades of Congress trying to figure out a way to deal with the harms that were being caused by the expanding role of the federal government and its agents in all of our lives in the United States at that point in time. Previously, the way that if you were harmed by a federal officer or agency, you could get some compensation is by going to your congressperson and getting them to pass private legislation saying, hey, the mailman drove through Patrick's garage door, and I would like Congress to give him $20,000. And so you had this whole process, much like, you know, writing a statute where Congress would vote on this. And by 1946, they were dealing with thousands of examples of private legislation. And they thought, hey, look, this is not a good way to administer this. What we should do is put all this together in a single statute, allow the harms of federal agents to be remedied, and let the courts figure that out. And so they did this in a what the Supreme Court has called unique way, because the FTCA's operative provision, which is 28 U.S.C. 1346b1, does three things simultaneously. It waives sovereign immunity, it provides jurisdiction, and it gives a cause of action for certain claims. And those claims are claims against the United States for damages, for injury or loss of property caused by the negligent or wrongful acts of an employee of the government while acting within the scope of their employment, under circumstances where the United States, if a private person, will be liable in accordance with the place where the act or omission occurred. And so essentially what this is doing is allowing you to bring a state tort claim in the form of a federal cause of action against the United States, not the individual officers, because what this is about, again, is providing a remedy to the harmed people. It's not about actually holding accountable or punishing the individual government employees. And of course, like much of the legislation that comes out of Congress, this statute is full of little requirements and exceptions, and there are 13 big exceptions to this waiver of sovereign immunity. Two of them are going to be applicable in this case, and one is called the discretionary function exception. And this has really been a head scratcher for the courts since 1946. The Supreme Court's weighed in on many occasions, although the last was 1991. And the lower courts are just hopelessly lost about this. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can read, for instance, the concurrence of Judge Bibas in the Third Circuit in a case called Z versus Haugen, where he says, like, nobody knows what's going on. There's a bunch of different circuit splits about how this works. Other circuit judges have said similar things. So let's look at the text quickly. The discretionary function exception excludes from the waiver of sovereign immunity. So it re-imports immunity for any claim based upon the exercise or performance or failure to exercise or perform a discretionary function or duty on the part of a federal agency or employee of the government, whether or not the discretion involved be abused. And so to modern ears, you hear discretionary function, you think, okay, basically anything that's not a ministerial act, something where the government says you have to do exactly these things. That sounds to us like that's something where you have discretion. But in reality, the discretionary function concept was a term of art at the time. This is language that was also used in the contemporaneously passed APA about discretionary functions being the sort of thing that powers exercised by agencies to deal with policy making, regulation, things like that. And so what this was actually aimed at was keeping courts from second guessing the wisdom of legislative and executive agency policy making. And so that's what this was all about. We've had the Supreme Court on probably half a dozen occasions weigh in on this and try to draw the lines, although sometimes it's sort of thrown its hands up and said, we don't know how to, but they don't apply in this case. And basically, it's come down to a two-step test that the court articulated in a case called Gaubert in 1991, where they say, okay, the discretionary function exception applies to any action that involves judgment or choice. That's the discretion piece of it. As long as that action, and this is, you know, unfortunately kind of circular, is the sort of judgment or choice that was meant to be protected by the discretionary function exception. And what the court has said is, for instance, in Gaubert, it gave an example where it said, of course, there will be situations where the actions involve constant decision making, constant judgment. The prototypical example is driving a car. But that's clearly not something that's meant to be protected by this. That's kind of the sort of mundane use of discretion. It's not like you're exercising some sort of specific policymaking a policymaking act of a federal agency for purposes of some sort of regulation. And so that we'll leave that there other than to say there's a lot of confusion in the lower courts in particular about how this should work and trying to figure out a way to keep this exception from swallowing basically everything that would otherwise be within the Federal Tort Claims Act. Another exception that Congress created in 1946 is called colloquially the intentional torts exception. And this exception says that you can't bring an FTCA claim for any claim arising out of assault, battery, false imprisonment, false arrest, yada, yada, yada. So it enumerates a number of intentional torts. It gets very confusing because there are some negligence-based torts that sound under this provision, and there are some intentional torts that are not included in it, but we call it that for shorthand. And so when you think about a case like this, we're dealing with a wrong house raid and you're going to have intentional torts, you'd think, okay, well, those torts will be excluded under the intentional torts exception either way, so we don't need to deal with the discretionary function exception. But there's a wrinkle, and the wrinkle comes in the form of what's called the law enforcement proviso to the intentional torts exception, which says that provided with regard to the acts or omissions of investigative or law enforcement officers, you can bring FTCA claims for assault, battery, false imprisonment, or three other intentional torts. And this provision is sort of the central issue that we'll be dealing with in this case, Martin. This is the one that will decide, how do you deal with FBI agents who raid the wrong house? The law enforcement proviso was enacted in 1974, so about 30 years after the FTCA was in place. And it was enacted in response to a pair of wronghouse raids in Collinsville, Illinois, at the sort of early years of the war on drugs during the Nixon administration and further growth of federal policing in the United States. And what happened was we had federal agents who were in the St. Louis area, went into Southern Illinois, trying to bust drug dealers and doing a very sloppy job of it. And in the course of that process here, we had them kicking in the doors of two completely innocent families, terrorizing them, trashing the houses, holding them at gunpoint, et cetera. And this made national news, and it was very upsetting to everyone. And the impetus of Congress's action here was to make sure that these sorts of wronghouse raids and similar abuses by federal police had a remedy under the Federal Tort Claims Act. Because again, that remedy is just to ensure that the person who's harmed is made whole. It's not to necessarily punish or hold accountable the individual federal officer. It's saying we, Congress, are waiving sovereign immunity so you can sue the United States when our employees screw up in some way that's tortious under state law. That is the unfortunately shortest way you can explain this sort of background, but that's where we're starting. So let's talk about this case, which is very much like the Collinsville raids. And so this case, we, the Institute for Justice, represent Katrina Martin, her son, who is at the time 7 years old, and her her then partner, who were all living in a nice upper middle class neighborhood in a house in suburban Atlanta. On October 18th, 2017, the FBI showed up before the sun rose to execute a warrant that was part of a larger series of raids against drug dealers. And the warrant they had was for an address, 3741 Landau Lane. They had done some sort of preparation where they drove by Landau Lane, but instead they ended up at the home of our clients, which was 3756 Denville Trace. And this is probably like five houses down. Its address is on a different street. The addresses of both houses are posted on the mailboxes. The officers knew that's where the addresses were. Nevertheless, they kick in the door of our client's home. Of course, they're startled awake by the sound of the door getting knocked in and stun grenades being deployed. Katrina tries to run to her son Gabe's room, but is pulled into a walk-in closet by her partner Toy, who, of course, everyone thinks we're defending against home intruders here. So Gabe, the seven-year-old, is left to hide and cry under his sheets. Meanwhile, the SWAT team in full tactical gear with assault rifles comes filing in, points the guns at everybody, pulls Katrina and Toy out of the closet. Katrina's just wearing a t-shirt. This is very embarrassing for her. They throw Toy on the ground, they handcuff him, they start yelling questions at him. And then they ask him what his address is, and he says 3756 Denville Trace, and everybody gets quiet. And then they find a piece of mail, and they realize, oops, we're at the wrong house. So very quickly, they all get up, they let Toy go, they walk out of the house, they go down the street, they raid the correct house, and then the SWAT leader comes back and gives Toy a business card and says, hey, call my supervisor, and they can sort out what to do about the damage. And, you know, as you can imagine, woke up at 4 a.m. to armed intruders and the explosion of a grenade in your entryway was very traumatic, horrifying for the seven-year-old Gabe, who dealt with a lot of fallout from this. Of course, the whole family dealt with a sort of PTSD of this terrifying situation, because, again, this is one of those things where it's not even wrong place, wrong time. You're just in your house. You're sleeping. There's nothing you could have done to prevent this from happening. It's a very terrifying experience. And so at the end of the process, the family brings its lawsuit, and it brings Bivens claims and it brings FTCA claims. And the only claims relevant for the Supreme Court case here are the FTCA claims. So I'm not going to talk anymore about Bivens. When they sue, the case eventually goes up to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and the 11th Circuit says, actually, no, the government still has sovereign immunity for all this stuff. And the way that it gets there is it divides up the claims that the family brings into the two buckets of sort of negligence claims and intentional tort claims. Because the 11th Circuit, it has said whenever there's overlap between the discretionary function exception and the proviso prevails. And so For the claims that are negligence-based, you don't have the law enforcement proviso because those are not intentional torts. And for those claims, the 11th Circuit says, here the discretionary function exception applies and therefore sovereign immunity shields these claims. And the way that the 11th Circuit gets there, despite there being no sort of regulatory policymaking as we discussed, is they say, first of all, the premise of discretionary function is that unless there's a source of federal authority that specifically says exactly what you have to do, then this exception is protecting you. And so here they actually say, hey, look, the FBI has no policies about how to make sure you're raiding the wrong house or you're raiding the right house. And because there are no policies, the discretionary function exception for policies actually protects FBI agents because they have the discretion to do basically whatever or nothing at all to make sure they're going to the right spot. Furthermore, there doesn't even need to be any real policy. There can just be a hypothetical policy anyway. And here, citing an earlier 11th Circuit case, they say, well, the decisions about how to locate and identify the subject of a warrant, those are kind of policy. And so since this was related to that, this is squarely within, that's the language they use, the discretionary function exception. So that's going to kill all the negligence claims. Then the bucket with the intentional torts, which are saved because the 11th Circuit, which is unique among the circuits in saying that the proviso trumps the exception, they say, okay, well, we're looking at these intentional tort claims now, and the way we're going to get rid of those and apply sovereign immunity nonetheless is by saying that the supremacy clause of the Constitution actually bars those claims on the theory that because the FTCA imports some elements from state tort law, that if we allow these claims that are borrowing from state tort law to restrict the actions of federal officers, that violates the supremacy clause. Now, that makes no sense as a concurrence in the case that established this rule, Denson versus United States, pointed out, because of course, the Federal Tort Claims Act is a federal statute and Congress selected state torts as the sort of guiding elements. And so to say that it's actually a state tort claim is to completely sidestep the point of the Supremacy Clause, which, as a refresher to everyone, says that the laws of Congress are the law of the land. And so here you have a federal court saying, actually, when Congress says you can bring these lawsuits, if it applies them to the executive branch of the federal government, it's actually violating the Constitution, which is a little bit wacky. And in fact, at the Supreme Court, the federal government has declined to even defend this particular issue that I'll get into in a second. And the court has had to appoint an amicus to argue it. But those are the ways in which the courts have gotten rid of all of the claims now for this family, the Martins. Even though, as I mentioned earlier, this law enforcement proviso was passed specifically to allow claims for things like wronghouse raids under circumstances that are indistinguishable from this case. And basically what the 11th Circuit and the federal government have said is the only way you can actually get to the claims is if you can first show that there was a constitutional violation and that it was clearly established under the same elements as qualified immunity, which is frankly not what the FTCA is supposed to be used to do. This is about torts. This isn't about accountability or holding someone liable individually. This is just about providing remedies for the tortious acts of federal employees. And so we petitioned the Supreme Court for cert on both the issue of the Supremacy Clause and the discretionary function exception as it applies to the law enforcement proviso. And the court granted cert on the two issues, which are the Supremacy Clause issue, whether the Constitution's Supremacy Clause bars claims under the FTCA when the negligent or wrongful acts of the employees has some nexus with furthering federal policy and can reasonably be characterized as complying with the full range of federal law. That's the language that the 11th Circuit uses. And second, the discretionary function exception, which the question there for the court is whether the exception is categorically inapplicable to claims arising under the law enforcement proviso. And so you have this larger question of what to do with the fact that the law enforcement proviso could potentially conflict with the discretionary function exception. And so what this case is really about is whether the two conflict and if they do, what the court should do about it. Of course, you also have this overlay of the supremacy clause and how that applies, but that's very closely related because of the way the 11th Circuit has applied it to the way that the discretionary function exception operates. And so that's a very long and technical way of saying this case is really about What, if anything, still exists in American law to allow the victims of abuse at the hands of federal police to have a remedy? Because the Bivens cause of action is not in play in this case at this point, but the Supreme Court has taken quite a bit of the wind out of the sails on that. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, did so on the theory that it's the job of Congress, not the courts, to say when a cause of action should be allowed, because that's a matter of policy. And here, now we finally have that cause of action. We're looking at the Federal Tort Claims Act passed by Congress, the proviso that Congress amended in 1974. And nevertheless, you have the government and courts carving up these exceptions and saying, oh, nevertheless, sovereign immunity still bars your claim. Even if you run the whole gauntlet of the FTCA, we're going to provide this strange supremacy clause gloss and make sure that you actually can't bring your suit. And so the case is fundamentally about that separation of powers issue and about whether there's anything as an American that you can do if you're the innocent victim of tortious actions by federal police officers. Of course, if this were state police officers, you'd have to deal with qualified immunity, but otherwise you wouldn't run into these issues about the cause of action and some broader absolute immunity. And so that sort of brings us to where we are, what the court will be deciding. And it'll be interesting to see what things the court picks up on. I think the court is interested in the Supremacy Clause issue, but it's a lot less meaty than the discretionary function and proviso question, because the 11th Circuit is the only circuit in the country that's adopted the Supremacy Clause angle. And of course, a lot of the circuits have found the conflicts between the discretionary function exception and the law enforcement proviso, and they've all kind of cooked up different ways for dealing with them. On the one end of the spectrum, the 11th Circuit is the only circuit to say the proviso always trumps the exception. On the other end, you have the 7th Circuit saying, actually, it never trumps the exception. And then in between, you have the courts sort of drawing a lot of lines, because I think they've all recognized that with respect to this proviso, Congress and the Collinsville raids, that the normal actions of sort of domestic law enforcement are not supposed to be subjected to sovereign immunity. And so they've kind of come up with ways to skirt that issue or ways to distinguish the cases that they're applying, where, for instance, a lot of the cases involved the INS and immigration issues. And so the courts were to rely on that as a way to distinguish it from the Collinsville situation. But now, for the first time, we have the Supreme Court taking up this issue, and hopefully it will give us, us being the entirety of the bench and bar and everybody in the United States, it will give us some clear guidance on this point for the first time. And I think that that's very important to be done, especially as it coincides with the court's increasing restriction on the Bivens cause of action. And here we also have the benefit of being supported by a bipartisan, bicameral group of members of Congress, including Rand Paul, Thomas Massey, Nakia Williams, who's the representative in the district where the Martin family lives, all saying, hey, look, we provided a cause of action for exactly this thing. You have to let the Martins move forward. You can't continue as the judiciary carving exceptions into rules that we make. That's our job. And so we will see what the Supreme Court does with those questions. And of course, our opposing counsel in this case will be the U.S. Solicitor General. So it will be an interesting argument on April 29th. And at this point, I'm happy to answer any questions that folks may have. I know this has been a fire hose of information, but again, as I said at the beginning, fundamentally, we're talking about a very simple thing, which is whether you can hold federal officials to a remedy if they raid the wrong house. The long story of it is what I just spewed at you. So I'm happy to try to make this simpler and clarify anything that people might be interested in.
Great, Patrick, that was so helpful. Thank you. So first question, someone wants to know, can you speak to the standing of the government and or individual employees challenging kind of, I think, bringing challenges to sovereign immunity, kind of what that looks like?
Yeah, so there's no issue of standing here, because we both have we're the plaintiffs in the case, and we're bringing the cause of action under the Federal Tort Claims Act. But I think the sort of underlying question there is, how do they get to even bring this up? And I don't have a good answer. This Supremacy Clause thing is very strange. I think the 11th Circuit came up with it because it was frustrated by the fact that circuit precedent bound them from allowing law enforcement claims to go forward. And in the case where the court created this exception, it was a pretty questionable case with a very suspicious traveler at an airport. And the court thought, well, basically, we don't want this claim to go forward, but we're kind of stuck with the law enforcement proviso. So how can we get around it? And the 11th Circuit came up with sua sponte in a 2-1 decision, the Supremacy Clause bar, which the government has been happy to benefit from. But at least in all the briefing that I've read of the government, it's never, said that's right. It's just said, like, we have to apply this. And as I mentioned in this case, it's not defending this rule. So the Supreme Court's had to appoint an amicus to argue it.
Great. Very helpful. So this might be an unfair question, but do you have any inkling of how the court will decide? I think someone specifically wants to know if you feel like a particular justice will author decision. I think that's maybe a little too far into the crystal ball. But if you have any inklings, I think the audience would love to hear.
Yeah, I mean, this is always a question that everybody has and that every lawyer wishes they could answer.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you've got the devil on my shoulder saying, like, well, of course they're going to rule for me 9-0. What rule would do something differently? And on the other hand, you could say, like, well, the court is very protective of law enforcement, and so there's that angle here. So I can't say anything more than a sheer guess. But I think the Bivens of it all is actually a good indication that this court is likely to rule with us, notwithstanding what it might think from a policy perspective, and do so by saying, hey, look, as we explained in our Bivens cases, we are subordinate to the Congress when it comes to creating causes of action. And so in the same way that we're saying we don't want to create a Bivens cause of action for that reason, here where Congress has provided a cause of action, we're going to be very careful not to restrict that cause of action. So I do think, I think especially, we're coming in as the petitioners, so that's always a good rule of thumb that you're in a better position. Now, naturally, it's always a bad rule of thumb that you're litigating against the federal government in its own courts. But I do think that I'm optimistic that the court will decide this case in a way that allows the Martin family to proceed with their lawsuit, and hopefully in a way that, reads the language of Congress to actually have meaning in the law enforcement proviso.
Great. I think someone feels that, the facts feel pretty, in their words, unusual and extreme, and there's kind of no excuse for such errors. I think someone wants to know, why couldn't the court dispose of this case in that manner as a simple kind of negligence claim, arguing the policy was the determination of the address to raid?
So the court could do that. And one of the things that we had asked for as alternative relief when we filed cert was we said, hey, look, you, the Supreme Court, can simply summarily reverse this and just say, like, no, come on, do it again. This is ridiculous. The court didn't do that. So I take that to mean the court does want to get into these issues and suss them out a little more. And to the last question, combining here, I think that's another reason for some optimism, because I think anybody hearing the facts of this case will be outraged, because it really is. It's not a situation where you have, a criminal who's claiming excessive force, and so the fight is over. Well, you're allowed to, like, you can hit me some, but you hit me too much. Where here is just completely innocent people sleeping in their beds, complete screw up. The basis for why they raided the wrong house was the FBI agent claimed that he put the correct address into his GPS, but it took him to the wrong address. And in this lawsuit, when the plaintiff said, okay, give us the GPS and we'll try that again, and he said, oh, I threw it away. And so I think there's no dispute here at all that the FBI screwed up and that the plaintiffs did nothing wrong. And so that makes me think that given the court's taken this case, it doesn't want to just say, hey, these guys can go forward. We want to have a broader discussion about how this statute will work for the next 30 years.
Hopeful. So no worries if you can't answer this one, but someone wants to know, how are the claims in this case different than the 1983 claims that I think you were alluding to earlier?
Yeah, so the claims are different in two key ways. And so first is that Section 1983 provides causes of action for actions taken under color of state law, which means you can't bring 1983 claims against FBI agents in the normal course of their federal duties. And so that's the first problem with trying to hold accountable federal officers for constitutional violations, which is the second distinction here. 1983 claims, they can reach federal statutes, but typically we think of them as a way to vindicate constitutional rights. Whereas the claims here under the Federal Tort Claims Act are exclusively derived from torts. So instead of saying this was an unreasonable search and seizure, you're saying this action was actually assault, battery, and false imprisonment. And so those are the key distinctions between 1983 and the FTCA claims that we're dealing with here.
Great. So someone wants to know, could a ruling favoring the plaintiffs lead to changes in federal law enforcement protocols to mitigate liability risks?
Yeah, I mean, yes, of course it could. I think the issue is that the Federal Tort Claims Act is paying out these damages from a gigantic fund that's administered across the entire federal government. And so I think there will naturally be some sort of trickle down to like, hey, please stop raiding the wrong houses because we don't like paying people. But it's not quite the same individualized pressure that even the FBI would feel compared to like a local police department that's held liable for the actions of its employees. I think you could still see these cases being, you know, used from the perspective of Congress as a way to ensure that there are actual policies in place. Again, there were none here, although the frustration with a case like this is you say, like, well, what policy do you need? Check the address. That's a policy that every DoorDash delivery guy knows before he drops off your Chinese food. So if you're getting ready to kick in the front door and throw a flashbang grenade, you could at least check the numbers on the outside of the house or on the mailbox before you do it. And so there is a lot of weird tension here. And of course, you also just have the sort of political valences that might come with the actions of police representing one agency. So maybe the FBI or the ATF versus police representing, you know, the TSA or the US Parks. And so there's always like a lot of wrinkles that end up getting baked into how this stuff manifests as, you know, lessons being learned by the federal government, whether those lessons are taken to heart or rejected.
Definitely. So I think you touched on this a little bit, but, you know, what challenges do courts face in balancing the protection of individual rights against the need to allow federal employees discretion in kind of performing their duties?
Yeah, so I think the challenges, in especially in the FTCA context, are just the challenges of statutory interpretation. And so you have the situation here, and I will take on the more difficult iteration of this question next. But at the FTCA stage, the thing that makes it so unique is that you have the Congress already saying, hey, look, we've mapped out here are the things when we want the sovereign immunity to be waived, and here are the things when we don't. And furthermore, the liability that will exist if you're able to make it through the FTCA is liability at the feet of the federal government, not the individual officers. And the Supreme Court has on several occasions pointed out when it comes to the FTCA, because of that fact, we don't, meaning the courts don't, view the actions of these cases as the sort of actions that will chill the acts of federal law enforcement officers, because at the end of the day, they're not the ones who are going to be on the hook. Now, the harder iteration, and I'll start out by saying that the individual officer being shouldered with the damages sort of a complaint that we hear a lot in the context of qualified immunity is one that actually has very little basis in reality, because even when the law technically says individual Patrick is liable for this because he did bad police stuff, the government employer is almost always 99.9% of the time, via the research of Joanna Schwartz at UCLA Law School, it's going to be paid by the federal employer, not the individual. And the reason is because the federal individuals in most of these cases are going to be they're going to be judgment proof anyway. And so even from the perspective of the plaintiffs, although it seems nice in a kind of disembodied sense that you'd be able to hold accountable Officer Jones for his bad actions, if Officer Jones goes bankrupt and you don't get any damages, I mean, some people would be happy with that if they're coming from a purely vindictive standpoint. But people that are trying to get a remedy for constitutional violations, they don't even want necessarily the individuals to have to be on the hook. But the more difficult question embedded there is if you're looking at a constitutional claim, then you're saying, okay, well, how do we weigh the need to do important and dangerous and valuable federal policing work or state policing work with the needs to protect the rights of the individuals? And I think there are a lot of different schools of thought on the way to prioritize these things. The one that I hold personally is the Constitution sets these principles, and the Constitution, which was, of course, you know, drafted by the founders and then modified through the 14th Amendment and all that. What the founders and what our system was designed to accomplish was to say, hey, there are some things that we know will impose costs on our ability to govern. It's easy to govern if you're authoritarian China, because you just do whatever you want. And if people don't like it, too bad for them. Whereas our system is built to say, no, we are going to impose costs on the government in the form of telling them they can't do things that would be easier. And if they do do them, there will be consequences for them. And so I think we should be very zealous in safeguarding those consequences, because it's always easy to look in an abstract sense at a situation where you might not be sympathetic to the individuals involved and say, well, in this case, I don't like that person. And so it's really important for the police to be able to do X, Y, and Z. But if you take that principle and apply it across the board, you realize that a lot of the protections that we take for granted in our Bill of Rights actually have no teeth or very little bite. And I think that most of the people on this call would be concerned with that. I certainly am. And so I think that the principles that should guide us are that the Constitution, or in this case, the FTCA, should always be the final word on the question of where to draw the line.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much. I think unless there are any other audience questions, this concludes our webinar. But, you know, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our audience for their questions. Thank you, Patrick, for your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming news. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.